Call order of the House Committee on Healthcare. To all the witnesses, I need to warn you, we need to be expeditious because one of our members is having a baby shower at 4:30. We'd all like to be there if we can. Is that right? Huh? Is that you, Ron? Who is it? That's
no, not number five. Four is enough for me.
Okay. One, two, three, four.
Okay, well,
need one more.
You can start a public hearing on anything that you wish. I was going to say we could do a work session, but we don't have a chair.
Nope.
So if you want to start with 36.
Nope.
No? You don't want to start with 36?
Oh, yeah, let's do 36. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 3-6. Mr. Dameron, will you come and enlighten us, please? Sandy, will you tell us what it's about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 36 comes to us in an amended form. There is no revenue impact, but you should have a fiscal. This was scheduled on the 10th. We did not gavel in, so you should have meeting materials in your bill folder from the 10th. And that, and the fiscal should be with
copies would be great.
Your original packet. The bill modifies the list of entities that may be assessed fees by the Oregon Patient Safety Commission to fund operating costs of the commission. It caps the fee amount not to exceed $1.5 million that the commission collects in a fiscal year. It also authorizes the commission to adjust the cap fee based on the consumer price index. It allows the public health officer or that officer's designee to be a member of the commission, declares an emergency, and is an effective with an effective date of July 1, 2007. The Senate floor vote was 28 ayes and 2 excused.
No noes, huh?
No noes. And you should also, from previously, we had written testimony from Providence Health Systems that you should have a copy of, and also the Department of Human Services dated May 10th. We acknowledge those for the record.
Okay. Joel Young, you want to join us? Please introduce yourself, sir.
Representative Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jim Dameron. I am the administrator of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, and I'm here to speak to you today in favor of Senate Bill 36A. I've spoken to the Subcommittee on Health Policy about the Patient Safety Commission. We were created by the legislature and given the mission of reducing adverse events, reducing medical errors in Oregon's healthcare systems, and encouraging a culture of patient safety. We are a small group, but we are a busy group. We have created a voluntary and confidential reporting program. We champion quality improvement activities. We help build consensus around tough issues such as healthcare-acquired infections. Senate Bill 36A, you've heard, will do three things. It will ensure stable funding for the Patient Safety Commission into the future. The commission was built initially on a very simple premise, voluntary reporting, mandatory assessment of fees. So a hospital, a nursing home, an ambulatory surgery center, et cetera, could choose to be included or excluded from the reporting program, but they needed to support it via a fee. That was the original idea. We saw that as equitable and fair. We saw that as creating rational incentives. No one could opt out to gain a financial advantage. We thought it would help drive participation in the voluntary piece. Unfortunately, there was some vague language in the initial statute. Senate Bill 36 would clarify that language. And in consultation with our partners, we put a cap on that of $1.5 million. That's a maximum. Our current budget is about $500,000 a year. And the third part, at the request of Department of Human Services, there was an amendment to modify language about the public health officer who is an ex officio member of the board, allowing the public health officer to designate someone to attend and vote on board meetings on her behalf. Just a matter of convenience and a matter of allowing the commission to do its business to gain a quorum. All right. So I think that's it, really. I believe we're doing good work. This would ensure that we can continue to do that good work into the future. You saw in the Senate vote, it was 28 to nothing. Folks have been very supportive The professional associations have been supportive of the commission's work, and I think we have begun to make some progress. Questions for
the questions director,
administrator, actually.
Young?
Representative Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Joel Young, and I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here on behalf today of Dr. Grant Higginson, also from the Public Health Division. And I'm going to be extremely brief. I think Jim laid out what the bill does, and Sandy also, of course, described that to you. I just want to underscore how important it is to have stable funding to take on something like the reduction of adverse events. And this stable funding will be spread across all the participating entities, the various participating types of entities. And I think that really strengthens the activity of the commission. It provides also some flexibility, as Jim mentioned, for the state public health officer. Originally, at the time this bill was drafted, the public health officer role was separate from that of the state administrator for the public health division. They're now combined into one. And this provides the kind of flexibility that allows our commission responsibilities to be undertaken with as much seriousness as they deserve while taking care of our other public health responsibilities. So I guess what I want to do is just sort of, again, close with saying that these resources, which then can be dependably planned on by the commission, will allow it to move beyond gathering of reporting of adverse events, which is critical. But ultimately, the most critical thing is that reporting be translated into change in the system to the prevention of adverse events. I believe this bill will contribute to that and to the safety of all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? There are no opponents.
No, not that I'm aware of. The Hospital Association is officially neutral, but said they would not stand in the way. So.
And one of the systems has sent a letter of support.
Correct.
Okay, well, I'll close the public hearing on SB 36A and open a work session on SB 36A.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would move Senate Bill 36A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on that motion? Call the roll, please. Excuse.
Representative
Brown. Aye. Representative Cannon. Aye. Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelson. Aye. Vice Chair Kotek. Excuse.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Rickinson.
Excuse.
Chair
Green.
Aye. SB 36
goes
to the floor. Need a carrier?
I'd be happy to carry that.
Okay. You got it. Representative Gelser will be the chair. Okay. And we'll close the work session on SB 36A and open up a work session on SB 206. You remember we proposed dealing with SB 205 and SB 206, which had the odd position of one introducing language in sections that the other were deleting and added no end to the confusion. So the ultimate resolution of that is to amend Senate Bill 205 into 206. And I think we have amendments that do that, Sandy. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. In your packet, you should have the -1 amendments as well as a hand-engrossed 206 with that -1 amendment in it to show that the language that we needed from 205 did indeed get amended into 206. We got that this morning. I believe We sent the hand engrossed and the amendment to the Board of Naturopathic Examiners. They looked at it. The language was carried over. Upon my review, looks like all of what I had highlighted is carried over, and it reconciles any duplication or conflicts between the two bills.
And both of them were non-controversial. So.
Oh, correct.
There wasn't
correct.
Any controversy about them. It was right. Just a matter of we thought before we passed it we ought to clean up the craziness that
of the dueling sections, and that's what we think this bill does. So I'll be happy to have a motion on, let's see, I opened up the work session on 206, and on the amendment 206-1.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 206.
Is there any discussion on the amendments? Any objection? The dash ones are included in House Bill 206, and how about a motion on the bill itself?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 206 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on that amendment? Karen, will you please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator
Flores.
Aye.
Senator Joseph.
Aye.
Senator
Powell.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Rosenberg. Excused.
Vice Chair
Rosenberg. Aye. And I would accept. I wonder what mischief my co-chairs are up to. Both gone. Huh? Makes you a little nervous, doesn't it?
I believe, Mr. Chair, the Vice Chair Richardson is on his way from the airport.
I'm sure. I don't know. When both my Vice Chairs, I'm worried about a coup.
Oh. Motion for the consent calendar?
Yes, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 206 be placed on the consent calendar.
We have a motion to place 206 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? 206 will go to the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would ask that we temporarily suspend the rules to reopen Senate Bill 36 and allow Representative Bonamici to vote if she desires.
Is there any objection?
On which 36?
36.
Did you adopt the amendment?
Yes.
We adopted 36.
We had no amendment, Mr. Chair.
There was no amendment to 36A. The 36A. Right.
And I vote aye.
Please record an aye vote. Representative Bonamici on 36. Okay. Let's see what we want to do now. Let's go to let me open a public hearing on Senate Bill 191. Did that come to us from a subcommittee, or is it here for the first time?
It's here for the first time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, will you talk to us about it, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 191 amends the definition of pre-existing condition for the purpose of long-term care insurance. It removes the current prohibition on prior institutionalization conditions in long-term care insurance according to specified criteria in the bill. It requires the delivery of the policy summary with the individual life insurance policies that provide long-term care benefit. It also specifies that information be included in the policy summary. It specifies requirements for incontestability periods, and it requires offer of non-forfeiture benefits and specifies conditions. Requires the Department of Human Services to submit to Medicaid state plan an amendment to CMS. It declares an emergency effective on passage. We also have attached to our materials the dash A3s, and you also have written testimony from the ACLI that cannot be here today in support of the bill. They were part of the work group that came up with the dash A3s, and I believe we have the department here to speak to the bill and the compromise A3 amendments, Mr. Chair.
Let's have all three folks here. Mr. Ariel. Ms. Huddleston and Rob Johnson. A list of witnesses on this. Please tell us where we are.
They're in there. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joel Ariel, the administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We're here today to support Senate Bill 191, which comes to you having passed through the Senate. I'll start with a brief description of what long-term care insurance is and why it's important, and then talk in brief terms about the three parts of the bill. And then Julia Huddleston from DHS will talk more in more detail about the third part of the bill, which is the partnership aspect of the bill. And then, is it Scott?
Rob,
we'll talk about, I don't know what Rob will talk about. The long-term care insurance is the kind of insurance that's increasingly being bought by people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s to address the potential need they may have for nursing home care or other kinds of care later in life when they're unable to do some of the basic activities of daily living. We're talking about things like eating, dressing, going to the bathroom, etc. Long-term care policies then kick in because Medicare does not cover that kind of care if it's provided outside of a hospital context. So this insurance is designed to fill that gap. It's important for individuals as part of their future planning. It's also very important to the state, as Julia will talk about in more detail in a few minutes, because if you look at the state Medicaid budget, which itself is a big cost driver in the state budget, within Medicaid, long-term care, particularly nursing home care, is a major cost driver within Medicaid. So anything that can be done on the private side for people to better prepare themselves for these situations reduces the potential that people will end up in the state Medicaid program to have this kind of coverage. And of course, in order to get into the state Medicaid program at that point in your life, you have to spend down your resources to be eligible for Medicaid and so forth. So it's a situation that is pretty much in everybody's interest if it can be avoided, to be avoided. What does this bill do? We already have a long-term care insurance set of consumer protections in law. This bill, the first part of the bill, adds to those protections. If you look at page 2 of my testimony, you'll see a brief summary of some of the key provisions. It further limits the use of pre-existing conditions on these kind of policies. It limits policies where they try to restrict benefits just to institutional care. Increasingly, people want to access long-term care type benefits in their own homes or in less restrictive settings than a nursing home. It requires written explanations of denials of claims under Medicare. It provides for better protections for people who have a policy and then subsequently can't afford premium increases on the policy to keep some level of benefit in those situations. This is an interesting product for us because it's one of the very few products where we're more concerned about the price, initial price being too low rather than too high, because we have a history with this product when it was new and the actuaries didn't exactly know how to price it, of initial prices being very low for people, say, that buy it at the age of 50 or something. The stuff is bought on a basis of attained age, so you get a policy based on the fact that you're 50, then you carry through on that policy based on your age of 50. But if claims go up, the price can go up for you, and so you had people being priced out of the market before they ever got old enough to use the product. So protections around if you've paid premiums for a long time, and then there is the need for a rate increase, and that's becoming less because the actuaries are better and our reviews are better. Still, there will be those kind of situations, and it allows the person to be able to keep some level of benefit rather than lose the whole thing, their whole policy, if they can't pay the increased premiums. And then it also restricts further the ability of carriers to rescind policies based on misrepresentations. Generally strengthens the consumer protections on this product to make it more attractive and a better deal for consumers. The second part of the bill has to do with continuing education, and the bill requires agents or producers who are going to sell this product to go through 8 hours of initial training on the long-term care product, and particularly on the new partnership program and its relationship to state Medicaid. The basic nature of the partnership deal is that if a person buys long-term care at some earlier point in their life, subsequently does access their benefit and spends through that benefit, then has to go on Medicaid because they no longer have a long-term care benefit, it allows them to reduce their spend down by the amount that they contributed to their plan over time. So
please explain reducing the spend down.
Pardon? Oh, Medicaid spend down?
Yeah, well, the notion of reducing the spend down, I think some people... Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. Julia can give more detail on this too, but the core of that idea is that in order to be eligible for the Medicaid program, you basically have to spend down most of your assets essentially into poverty. And what this program does is say, whatever, if you spend, say, $20,000 over 20 years on your long-term care policy, then whatever you'd otherwise have to spend down, you get a credit for that $20,000. So you have to spend less money in order to access the state program.
The premiums, not if they paid $250,000 in benefits to you, would that not be included?
believe it's on the premium, right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julia Huddleston, DHS, it's on the premium, but what happens
that's
then...
That's not a great deal.
Well, what happens at the person's death, if they've gone on Medicaid, is the amount of the benefit they've paid for you is exempted from Medicaid estate recovery. And that is the great part of the deal. So then if you die and you have a house that you want to leave to your heirs, whatever you've collected in that long-term care insurance benefit isn't taken away from the proceeds.
Okay. You spend down, but the house isn't included in spend down. Or the car, I think.
That's correct, Mr. Cook.
So then, but you spend down, you can keep $20,000 or whatever you paid in premiums and your house.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you die, the lien on your house, if you'd received $250,000 in benefits from the long-term care insurance, the first $250,000 of the house would be exempted
from estate recovery. That's correct, Mr.
Recovery.
Chair.
Is that, this is a sort of a complex issue. Mm-hmm. Connecticut, I think, was the first state that mm-hmm. did this. And this is
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Connecticut and a few other states have had partnership programs. They've been successful there. One of the ways in which they've been successful is very few people have actually spent through their benefit and had to access Medicaid at all. And, of course, that's the main idea is to prevent people from having to go into the Medicaid program at all. Here in the Congress last year or the year before passed a law saying that now the partnership program would be open to all 50 states. So again, on the continuing education requirements, it's 8 hours of initial training, and then 4 hours in every two-year period after that, in order to sell long-term care. Those are the continuing education requirements, and those hours would count towards the normal 24-hour requirement that we have for our agents to have at least 24 hours of continuing education every 2 years. That is the area where we have the amendment today, and the amendment essentially says that there are people who have been selling long-term care for years, and those people are probably in a different position in terms of their expertise on the product than people who are new to the market. So that 8-hour initial requirement is looked at in the amendment in the sense that the amendment would allow the department to consider whether some of those folks should be exempted from some or all of that initial 8-hour requirement. Now, we've been in a lot of discussion with various parties on this, and people are somewhat concerned about that potential exemption. It's something that the industry and the agents sought, because I think they start with a valid case that people who've been selling it for 20 years are in a different position than people who've never sold it at all before. On the other hand, the partnership is new, and so the need to understand how the partnership works and its interaction with Medicaid on exactly the issues that the chair was just talking about and others is something that everybody would have to do. So our most likely scenario at this point is that nobody would get an exemption under a rule from us for the whole 8 hours, but perhaps for some part of it that related to the more general training, and then they would still have to do something with the partnership. But we have pledged to all parties that makes sense to us to have some flexibility here, but if we don't have consensus of the parties that the exemptions make sense, then we wouldn't grant any exemptions under the rule. That's what the A3 amendments would allow. Last issue in the bill is that it does authorize DHS to move forward and seek a plan amendment so that Oregon would become a partnership state and would have the benefits of the partnership. And on that note, I will turn it over to Ms. Huddleston to talk about the partnership.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, again, Julia Huddleston, DHS, for the record. The final sections of this bill amend Oregon revised statute that pertains to Medicaid eligibility and estate recovery after death in ways that Mr. Ario has talked about. It directs the department to seek a state plan amendment and to implement the long-term care partnership insurance policies. This is important because Oregon is getting much older. At the end of the last session, Governor Kulongoski directed the department to begin to convene a task force to look at the future of services to seniors and people with disabilities. One of our first findings simply had to do with the demographics. Today, 1 in 8 Oregonians is over age 65. By the year 2025, so 17 years from now, that number will be 1 in 5 Oregonians. And Oregonians who are among the oldest old, that number of folks 85 plus, today it's about 65,000. By 2025, it'll be about 95,000. And, of course, your need for long-term care and long-term services goes up the older you get. Most people do not understand Medicare. Most people believe Medicare will somehow come through to pay for long-term care. Medicare pays for long-term care under very restricted circumstances, in nursing facilities or in home health. It doesn't pay for the community-based care facilities that Oregon's a national model for. So what this begins to do is one of the steps that we're trying to take, it's the result of the task force work, to help people understand what's coming and to help in a lot of ways incentivize people taking personal responsibility and gaining personal knowledge of what aging means. We support this bill. We ask for your support. We're happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yes,
Mr. Chair. If I recall, early in the session, we had conversations about long-term care insurance and what percentage of the population today have long-term policies. If I remember correct, that was really small.
Mr. Chair, I know it's small. I don't have that percentage, but...
Yes. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Rob Johnson with the Oregon Healthcare Association. The number in nursing facilities in Oregon is just over 1%,
mm-hmm.
And the number in community-based care facilities is a little bit harder to nail down, but it's just under 1%.
I think you're asking about long-term care insurance.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Maurer, be a larger number than that have long-term care, but it's in the single digits still, I believe.
Right. And I believe in your handout, the insurance annual report that you provided, your first go at it, had that percentage in there. And one of the comments that was made was that long-term care insurance is not going to be the solution to this problem because we just there aren't enough people that can afford it or in the circumstance that they are going to buy it.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, if I may, the Department of Human Services completely agrees with that statement. We don't feel there's a single solution to the aging demographic, but there'll be multiple solutions. And this would be one small part of the solution. We hope to, after the state plan amendment is approved by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, work with the Department of Consumer and Business Services and our partners in the long-term care insurance industry to make this product more accessible and more affordable to a larger number of people.
I did a set of focus groups once on long-term care insurance. I had a project called the Social HMO for 20 years that was providing long-term care insurance as a part of Kaiser's Medicare insurance program. And when we talked to people about thinking about wanting long-term care insurance, we couldn't get anybody in any of the focus groups to think about the fact that they might need to go into a long-term care institution. And they just refused to think about it, and they had all kinds of, I'm going to marry a woman that's 30 years older than me, younger than me, and has lots of money, and she'll take care of me, and everybody in my family lives to 100 and then dies in their bed, and all these things. And we finally pushed and said to them, well, now imagine you're in a wheelchair and we have you at the front door and you're about to go to a nursing home. What do you do? And the answer was, we called Dr. Kevorkian. And it turned out this was before Death with Dignity. And Kevorkian was a complete folk hero among people in my age group. And it was very interesting. People don't want to buy long-term care insurance. But this really makes it much more of a state protection plan rather than a long-term care plan if people are interested in that.
Well, the only other comment I had was Oregon is very good about keeping people out of nursing homes, which is a good thing, but these policies then need to reflect that and to encourage that status so that we don't go the other way, because it's still, it's expensive, but it's still a whole lot cheaper to keep them in their home.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, yeah, there are two essential, in broad terms, new consumer protections that are increasingly part of the long-term care insurance product, and one of them is a great deal of flexibility about benefits, so we avoid exactly the situation you're talking about where the person can only access the benefit for very specific types of services and typically very high-end services, so the programs are now structured. That particular thing of requiring nursing home care to get the access is prohibited in the bill, and in general the products are more flexible in terms of the different types of situations they will cover. The other thing is, on the financial side, the products are increasingly flexible in terms of if the premiums do go up and you can't afford them, or even if they don't go up and you can't afford them for some reason, that you can take a lower benefit rather than lapse the product and lose it. So there's more flexibility about taking whatever you put into the product, you get some kind of benefit out of it, even if you aren't able to afford the full benefit in the future. And then there's a lot of new rules about how these things are priced, because we have some experience now, both on the industry and our side, to make sure that there aren't as many of these situations where the product is underpriced to start with and you end up with these rate increases in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. When I first looked at the bill and saw the enhanced consumer protection and the increased education, I thought the industry wouldn't be supporting it, but then when I realized that the incentive increases demand, I realized why they are. And I don't see Mr. Magnin here, so maybe you can answer the question about, in his written testimony, it said that in some of the states that choose to participate, it has created greater incentives where the program is operational. With the increased demand, have the prices been lowered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I don't think I could say that the prices have been lowered yet, because the costs of medical care like this continue to go up. But it is the days when, as the chair described, people, this wasn't on anybody's radar screen, and to the extent it was, they didn't want to think about those things. That part is changing. The state of Oregon, for instance, now has this as an employee benefit. So each year when you go through your PEB choices, you can purchase long-term care, and there have been some new take-ups there. So, and a lot more employers are picking it up. So over time, I think it could lead to reductions in prices as we get a larger participation. But today, I would say the problem is still on the other side more, that the prices haven't stabilized a lot, and that's been a lot of the focus on the product, is to try to get enough experience there so you can accurately predict cost and not have as much volatility in pricing.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, I don't think you've had a chance to test
it. I haven't yet, but I'll go ahead and do that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Johnson with the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent long-term care facilities in Oregon, ranging from licensed in-home care agencies to assisted living residential care facilities, as well as nursing facilities. And I just wanted to come and express our support for Senate Bill 191 for the reasons that Mr. Ario and Ms. Huddleston have articulated. And I think the point that Representative Maurer made about encouraging the choice that characterizes Oregon's long-term care system is very well taken. I think that's one of the most important pieces of this bill. And it helps to encourage people to plan for their future. So with that, I'll end my testimony, be very brief, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 191 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 191. We have an amendment, is that right?
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 191. The dash A3 amendment to Senate Bill 191A.
Which is that? Isn't it the dash 3 amendments to 191A?
Or it can be or the 191 to A3.
Okay. Is there any discussion on those amendments?
Mr. Chair, what are these? Sorry, I'm just looking at it for the first time. Did we hear about these amendments?
Yeah, that's the one that allows existing agents selling this product from, there being rules that would allow them to waive some of the requirements, the education requirements. Any objection to the A3s? A3s are part of Senate Bill 191. How about a motion on Senate Bill,
Mr. Chair,
191A as amended?
I would move Senate Bill 191A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on it? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Senator Flores.
Aye.
Senator Felton.
Aye.
Senator Mallard.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek.
Excuse.
Aye. Senate Bill 191A, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry it, sir.
Okay.
Study back up on something I once knew. close the public hearing on Senate Bill 191. And, I'm sorry, a work session on Senate Bill 191. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 135A. We have some witnesses on this. Can you tell us what it's about, Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 135A revises certain provisions relating to the scope of practice for occupational therapists. It requires the occupational therapist and the therapist assistant to comply with the continuing education requirements. This has no revenue or fiscal impact. It left the Senate floor with 25 ayes and 5 excused.
They don't work very hard over there, do they? okay. We have Ms. Holgate, Mr. King, and Mr. McCall. Is that right? All present at Hammersmith.
Chair Greenick, Felicia, and members of the committee, Felicia Holgate on behalf of the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board. Sandy has outlined it's basically to require the same continuing education for applicants coming to Oregon as we require for those that renew their license. The other one is the board had concern of applicants who had been out of practice for more than 10 years in some cases and set up a reentry program where applicants who have been not licensed and not practicing anywhere for more than for 3 years or more have to go through a reentry program that's been set up at Pacific University, the only school of OT, of occupational therapy. And they can either do that or retake the exam. The other portion that was dealt with was changing our definition. We wanted a very detailed definition that was in the National Association. We took that out and have now adopted that by rule. The board already took that action because legislative council recommended a very short and what we thought was too vague definition, so we're leaving our definition as is and adopting it into rule with a few amendments that have been agreed to and worked on with the physical therapist and the speech, language, and audiology therapists. With me is Alan King, a board member, and unless you have some questions for him, that's we respectfully request that you pass the bill.
Our speech and occupational, I mean, are speech and audiology included in?
No, they are not. They just had some concerns with the language in the original bill, which we, I think, have taken care of.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to speak to that. I'm John McCulley, representing the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association, which is the professional association for the speech pathologists and audiologists. We did work with the board on some language that could be added to the administrative rules to clarify where there might be an overlap of services that are provided normally in the purview of speech pathologists, but sometimes could be provided by occupational therapists. We're going to be continuing those discussions. The professional associations are working together to make sure that each of the professions is comfortable with what the others do. But we agreed to the language that the board is adopting relative to administrative rules to clarify some issues we had with the National Model Act, and we're comfortable with the bill that's before you and encourage you to move it.
Well, it'd sure be nice if any two professions could get along. Yeah. We haven't seen much of that. Mr. King?
I have no comments unless you have questions for me.
You're just here to back for backup.
Practicing occupational therapist board member.
Oh, good.
So, any questions?
Yes, any questions?
Thank you. I don't have a question, Mr. Chair, but I have a comment. There are a few opportunities that we have to recognize and appreciate the work of occupational therapists, and I really believe that occupational therapists are some of the great unsung heroes in the health occupations. And I know we on this
committee recently had the conversation about autism and autism services and the work that occupational therapists do with children with disabilities, both in terms of gaining independence in school, supporting their academics through things like being able to hold pencils, to be able to visually track items, to be able to sit in their seats, the sensory integration therapy that helps children better understand where their bodies are in space, to control and contain their behaviors, and to interact appropriately with their family and their friends and their classmates, really helps people become very independent. And when I first heard about an occupational therapist, I was really curious why, you know, a one-year-old would need help with their occupations. And I think many people have that response when they hear about occupational therapists. But if we think about encouraging independence in people, occupational therapists are an amazing occupation. I just want to thank you for your work.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Representative Gelser. I did, in the last paragraph, put some other examples of what occupational therapists do, and it certainly is delightful to be in front of a committee who that recognizes the difference between OTs and PTs.
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
I have to take a slightly contrary position. It's my experience that you want to avoid the circumstances that would require you to have much contact with occupational therapists, as I learned earlier this year. But once I needed them, I was very happy to have them.
Yes, sure. These changes are, if you can help me put these into context with other states around us, are we raising the bar higher than other states? Are we the same?
I think probably in most states we're about the same. It's something we've been doing administratively, but it hasn't been in our statute. There are some states that have some kind of a reentry or require retaking the exam. For some states don't have that. Some have 5 years. It varies from state to state. Our board feels very strongly that if somebody has been out of practice for more than 3 years, they really need to look at how to make sure they're competent in practicing in Oregon. The CE requirements, almost all states have some kind of continuing education, and I think it's probably within the average of what is required in other states.
Is there a shortage of occupational therapists in the state of Oregon?
There still is. The workforce needs assessment group that does that still shows occupational therapy as one of the ones that is. The need is growing, but so are the licensee numbers. We have just, in the last 3 years, gone up by close to 300. The need is growing, but we are getting more into the state. There's only one occupational therapy school, Pacific University.
I do want to comment. I was kidding about not telling the difference between PT and OT, but the fact is I spent a week in rehabilitation facility after fairly serious bilateral knee surgery, and I did probe, and the occupational therapist, I said, well, what's the difference between occupational and physical therapy? And well, occupational therapy does this and physical therapy does this. I said, well, yeah, but yesterday the physical therapy was doing it. Well, there's, yeah, but it's the occupational therapy does this, physical therapist does, but yesterday the occupational therapist was doing that. And one of the problems we have in this state is there are large areas of the state where we're not going to be able to adequately supply physical therapy and occupational therapy. And somewhere we need to figure out how to get the ability to cross-train people and to have folks who are physical therapists who can do some semblance of occupational therapy and occupational therapists who can do some semblance of physical therapy, because we're just not going to get enough in John Day and Pendleton and, mm-hmm. and so many patients in the state. I really would urge you to keep that in your mind as you're thinking of the future of your profession. And I've urged the people at Pacific, I've contacted specifically with their deans to talk about this as a specific issue, because it's. I don't think we're going to be able to keep the supply where we need to keep it, both for children and for seniors.
Those are the, Chair Greenlick, those are the two big areas where it'll continue to grow.
My comment to that is that, and I've said this before, historically Oregon is really good about keeping the gate closed to providers of many professions in the state, because the supply far outstripped the demand, and so we had the opportunity to keep, you know, the faucet you know, turned down. But today, that's not the reality in many professions where the demand far outstrips the supply, but yet our spigot is still turned off. And so we need to open this up and rethink about how we license professions and think outside the box.
Thank you, President Maurer. We don't have an amendment on this. Thank you very much for your testimony, and can I have a motion on the bill? Okay, hold on. Thank you, Sandy. My retraining hasn't worked very well. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 135. Open a work session on Senate Bill 135. And can I have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 135A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion on that motion? Karen, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores. Excuse.
Representative
Kelson.
Aye.
Representative
Howell.
Aye. Vice Chair
Kochak. Aye. Vice Chair Rodriguez. Excuse. Why don't you just note those, excuse. Aye. And this seems safe for the consent calendar. Correct. Have a motion on them?
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate Bill 135A be placed on the consent calendar.
Any objection? 135A will be on the consent calendar. Move to the floor with a due pass recommendation on the consent calendar. And I'll close the work session on SB 135A. Let's open a work session on 163, on Senate Bill 163. And I've asked for a DHS representative to join us and give us a better explanation on what this bill is about and why it's useful.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Wally Schaefer. I'm the medical director at the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. Speaking in favor of Senate Bill 163, and this bill has already had a public hearing at both subcommittees, healthcare subcommittees, so I won't belabor the points, but basically the bill seeks to allow the exchange of protected health information between managed care organizations that are treating Oregon Health Plan clients. The current statutes already allow disclosure of information without an individual's authorization under certain circumstances, and what this bill seeks to clarify is that managed care organizations are health care providers that are covered entities so that they are allowed to exchange physical and mental health information for treatment activities and health care operations. As you probably know, the publicly funded behavioral health care system and the physical health care systems are separate, and getting those two parts of the system to work together is one of the top priorities of the Department of Human Services. And one of the motivations for bringing this bill forward now is that DHS has an expectation that each of the mental health organizations and each of the managed care organizations that provides physical health to Oregon Health Plan clients, that each of those will develop collaborative projects together. And one of the barriers that the health plans have found is that there's this restriction on exchange of health information because the current statutes aren't clear that the managed care organizations are covered entities that can exchange information for activities like quality assessment and quality improvement, case management, and care coordination. And I will tell you that this problem is still alive. I just came from a meeting earlier this afternoon of all the quality improvement coordinators from the mental health organizations and managed care physical health organizations, and they were asking what the current status of Senate Bill 163 is, and we told them we have another hearing this afternoon. So it's the need to be allowed to exchange information is a real one. The discussion of this bill at the previous hearings has, especially at the Health Access Subcommittee, has revolved around the balance between what the delivery healthcare delivery system needs or thinks it needs to improve care and the rights of individuals to keep their medical information private. Now, there are different levels of or types of information, and I think different levels of concern. One type of information is aggregated data, which is not individually identifiable, but, for example, the number of people with a certain diagnosis like depression or the number of people with that are taking certain medications. And we want the managed care organizations to be able to have that information mutually for planning and for care coordination. And obviously there are some safety and quality concerns if the mental health and physical health organizations don't have the information that the other has.
Is that information excluded now?
It's excluded now because the current statutes aren't clear that the mental health and physical health managed care organizations are covered under the current statute. So there's a hesitancy and a because of the uncertainty, the lack of clarity in the current laws, there's a hesitancy to exchange that information, and so it's a barrier. I think the main concern has to do with individually identifiable information and basically questions raised as to whether there are enough restrictions in the current state laws, and in particular question raised by Representative Gelser, if an individual doesn't want their information disclosed, would that request for restriction be honored? So I did come up with an answer to that question, which is not a particularly satisfactory answer, but it's that they should try to honor those requests for restriction. And I'll tell you where the answer comes from. There was a collaboration of the Oregon Health Information Security and Privacy Collaboration that published a report in February. And this was a collaboration between the Oregon Health Quality Corporation and the state's Office of Health Policy and Research. So they reviewed the HIPAA rules, the state laws, and privacy best practices, and there are sections on the release of information without consent. There are sections on consumer and patient rights, and let me just read you sentence from the section on requests for restrictions on disclosure. I can make this whole report available to anybody that's interested. It's 17 pages long, but this one section says, healthcare organizations need to allow patients/consumers the opportunity to request partial or complete protected health information access restrictions to their medical record. Such restriction requests should be honored where feasible. And so, even if the HIPAA rules specify that even if restrictions on disclosure are agreed to by the healthcare provider, that those restrictions can be not followed if it's an emergency type situation. So that's basically the way the current standards of practice are. And what I will say in conclusion about this bill is that if it doesn't pass, that situation will still exist. But if it does pass, it will be very helpful to the mental health and physical health organizations in their quest for better coordinated care, because the goal is improved health outcomes and better patient-centered care that allows for coordination of both the physical and emotional aspects of care. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible to develop an amendment that would allow the exchange of that aggregated data in order to improve the overall quality of care and to better understand kind of those systemic needs? And that was discussed at the Health Policy Subcommittee quite significantly, but that would continue to protect the private identifiable data. So it seems like such an amendment would meet both the needs of privacy and the needs of the organizations to exchange that non-identifiable aggregate data for research purposes.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Gelser, it's hard to, at least it's been hard for us to come up with amendments that would not put greater restrictions in place that that are currently then are currently in the current laws, and so you know requiring, I mean, an individual's authorization to release information is already considered the best practice, but to have a requirement that couldn't be breached, for example, in the case of emergencies, which may arise between mental health and physical health organizations, hard to. I guess the DHS wouldn't be supportive of that.
Well, maybe you could help me understand. Mm-hmm. If I'm a member of an IPA, let's say Mid Valley IPA here, and there are several doctors in it, it's an individual practice association, so is there a centralized computer record on medical information of all those doctors, or do they have individual medical records?
They have individual medical records. However, some of the information is available to the IPA.
Well, talk to me about that.
I mean, that's what I'm trying to find out. Right now, if I'm a member, is there a central database of IPA that has? Let's just talk about my medical information now. I'm a member of Kaiser, and I know there is a central database.
Right. I mean,
it's Kaiser. Mm-hmm. But is there in the IPA so that? Is all my medical information available, not the mental health, that's a separate question, but the medical, on a central database so that Dr. A sees me in his office and I've only seen Dr. B before that, will Dr. A know what my diseases are and things like that?
Chair Greenlink, there is claims information that's available, claims that have been paid through the IPA, so information on diagnosis and some of the information on medications would be available, and that in fact is the type of information that might be helpful to exchange with a mental health organization if there's questions of management.
Let's keep it inside first.
Okay.
If I may, let me push a little on this. Now, let's say in Dr. A, I told Dr. A, I don't want my medical data to be available to anybody else. The claims information would still be available on a central database.
Mm-hmm.
There wouldn't be any way to avoid that because he's filed a claim and he's put a diagnosis on it. And so that even though he's excluded under HIPAA, say, from giving anybody else access to my medical information, the organization has a claims database.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's go over to the mental health. I'm also being treated for depression over in the mental health program. I don't know what that MCO is there, but is it the same situation at 10? I see psychiatrist A, and I don't want my data out, but psychiatrist A and B and everybody else is putting stuff in a claims file. Is that right?
That's right.
And that data is there as a claims. It's not a medical record in an ordinary sense. It's HIPAA-protected data.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in a claims file, and psychiatrist C could see me at the emergency room when I'm in, say, in an overdose or something, and will have the information about me out of the claims record. Is that right? Will that be available as a treatment instrument at that time? Well, that's psychiatrist.
Okay, that information would not necessarily be available for treatment at that time. I mean, they'd have to have a way of accessing the claims information.
It is in the database. My identifiable number with, say, the treatment of severe depression is in. Now, is that the same identification number that's in the medical side of the identification number? So if we're talking about exchanging data, would we then be able to put my severe depression diagnosis in the claims record with my prescription use in the IPA, would those data be able to be linked? I think that's at the heart of what we're talking about here.
Chair Greenlee, yes. I mean, that data can be linked in the Oregon Health Plan system. Whether it would be available at the time of a emergency situation,
but
that's not necessarily the case.
But now it'd be useful for somebody to tell us what's useful about linking that data. And I think I know because I'm a medical care researcher and I've organized medical care, but I don't think the committee has heard from anybody why, except that people feel it's useful. Why it's useful to put those two data sets together?
Well, Chair Greenlick, I can provide some information, but we actually have some representatives here from managed care mental health organizations. So
somebody come up and tell us why that's worth overcoming the concern about the sharing of private information. We'd like to be convinced about that.
Chair Greenlick, my name is Jim Russell. I'm the director for Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. That's the managed care organization.
The one where I'm being treated.
Exchanging information with the Mid-Valley IPA.
Mr. Chair, I'm Cindy Becker. I'm the director of COHO, Coalition for Healthy Oregon.
So you asked a couple of questions. What one could I help with first?
Well, I think the most important one is there are some of us that say we start with the presupposition that data ought to be kept private. That's where we begin. So we need to overcome that concern. And what we're hearing is some great interest in sharing that data.
Right.
And as a researcher, I can figure out all kinds of ways how I can tell you how to improve treatment, having done that.
Right.
But what we haven't heard is what's compelling about that. Why you need to do that in a way that will allow us to feel okay about overcoming what might be some concerns on the part of some of the people in either of your organizations for not sharing the data.
Well, for me, that concern is sharpest for an individual. And the benefit accrues to that individual. So what I know right now is if you're a physician working for the IPA and you call one of the local mental health offices and say, I've got Jim in my office, he says he's being seen by your clinic, can I talk to his therapist? The receptionist would tell you that without a written release, I can't acknowledge that that person is in care. What would happen with this bill is that the receptionist could acknowledge that person is in care after confirming that it was an Oregon Health Plan member. The concept is, kind of as you were saying, within two physicians within an IPA, that there really is just one insurance plan. It's the Oregon Health Plan. So it's not separate entities. And then what would happen within the mental health organization is there would simply be that acknowledgement, and then we need a release from that individual to be able to take the conversation any further.
That's not what the bill is talking about.
The bill talks about the possibility of releasing information, and I'm speaking. Sometimes I feel like I'm the problem child here.
Well, said something that's not in this bill. This bill says specifically may disclose protected health information of an individual without obtaining an authorization from the individual.
Yes, that's
right. You just said they would be required to obtain authorization.
I'm saying what our practice would be, and I think you're very correct to, I apologize for having an opinion about your actions. But
as long as it's a favorable
then with your permission, to look at what the bill really says and what the law permits, and to take no false assurance from me about what I think should really happen. Physicians are generally mad at mental health practitioners because they're having difficulty engaging them in a collegial conversation about appropriate care for an individual.
Cindy, can you help us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the one thing that I think is important for everyone is the language around sharing information without consent is no different than what's in the existing statute. And there's a whole long list of providers who can share information without consent under certain circumstances. So this bill is not changing that language at all. What this bill is doing is adding mental health organizations and fully capitated health plans to that list. So there is, for example, opportunities for the sharing of information at the clinical level right now. This is adding those two. And I think it's important that neither the mental health organizations or the fully capitated health plans seek to share information without consent as the first way to go. Clearly, if that both
parts of the system try to get that consent. However, there may be situations that require care coordination, emergency situations or other situations that cannot get consent. So it's for very specific purposes. It's not just on a day-to-day basis. You just go ahead and share information. So that really, that language is in accordance with HIPAA. There were lots of folks who looked at this at the state level a number of years ago when HIPAA first came into being. So this is not inconsistent with that. What we're just trying to do here is allow two additional entities that are not specifically cited in statute to add those to the list so that they can share that information for the benefit of individuals and also for the benefit of planning for the community, because we know there is a significant relationship between behavioral health and physical health.
Yes. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on the question that the chair asked, with helping to understand why this is a good idea and why it outweighs an individual's privacy. I understand that it just adds something else to current language, but this relating clause would actually allow us to go back and further restrict the information sharing abilities that are in that current statute. That's what I would be inclined to do, would be to write an amendment that narrowed that to make sure that we weren't releasing personally identifiable information. And I haven't been able to hear from anyone, besides the argument that it's currently in statute, why there's any reason that this is a good idea. And I don't understand how it helps the patient. I don't understand the benefit of seeking consent unless you can't get it and then you do it anyway. That makes me wonder what the value of consent is anyway. If it's great if you give it, but if I don't give it, you're going to take it from me anyway. So help me understand what benefit this provides beyond it's already in statute, because I'm concerned about the statute as it is. I think we should probably change it and narrow it to provide greater protection.
Mr. Chair, can I interrupt here for...
Please.
Okay.
We're in work session, so...
Okay.
Let's go at it.
Do you believe today, this is for Representative Gelser, if I may, that you can sign a form and say, I want no protected health information disclosed, period, out of my provider's eyes?
Representative Maurer, that had been my understanding because I have signed such pieces of paper. However, at our last meeting, Cindy Becker let me know that if I had told my marriage therapist, I'm not seeing a marriage therapist, but if I was, that my marriage and family counselor could call my family physician and share with my family physician what it was that was happening there, and that even if I said I don't want that to happen, they could do that and there would be no penalty for them, that it would be a good idea for them to follow my wishes, but they wouldn't. And I think that that's a problem in the law. So through this process, I've become aware that there is not the ability to do that. I think that we should own our own health information. That's why it's called protected health information. And this whole process has raised for me that this is an area of law that I believe needs attention.
Okay. And I would suggest to you that the information that you provide to a provider is by law, not your protected area. It is actually the property of that clinic or that organization that you provide that information to. And that let's just, rather than deal with information between Dr. A and Dr. B, that when you come to my clinic and we provide you a service, there's an expectation that I'm going to be paid for that service. I have a contract with an insurance company, whether it's a private insurance company or whether it's the federal government, and that these contracts require me to give them pieces of information that are PHI, protected health information, name, date of service, and diagnosis codes, and also a CPT, which is the level of service. And that is a contract between the provider and the contractor, the Blue Cross, Medicaid, etc. And that the patient doesn't have any ability.
Mid-Valley IPA.
Excuse me?
Or Mid-Valley IPA.
Or Mid-Valley IPA. The patient has no authority to stop that contractual obligation between the provider and the insurance company, because I, as a provider, want to get paid for the services that I provided. And so even without disclosing an actual progress note about a visit, I am disclosing diagnosis codes, dates of service, because I have to in order to get paid. And so I don't believe there's any way that you could restrict it more and make the system functional. In fact, I think you would make the system more dysfunctional than it already is today.
And Representative Maurer, I don't have a problem with providers billing health insurance companies and telling them what they're doing. Obviously, that needs to be happening in order for people to be reimbursed for services. The problem that I have is one provider, if a patient goes to a provider, and here we're talking about mental health organizations, is disclosing extremely personal information. They're maybe even nervous about going and seeking medical attention. I think it is a reasonable expectation that our medical information is private. I don't think a person, for example, that goes to seek treatment for a sexually transmitted disease should be worried or have to wonder whether or not that physician, that nurse practitioner, because they decide it's in that person's best interest that they call their mental health counselor to let them know that they have a sexually transmitted disease. I don't think that that's appropriate.
Well, but they're going to call the state and report it.
They're going to call the state and report it, but they're not going to call another provider that's seeing that person. Yeah. Although the information, the billing codes to go to the insurance, I understand that belongs to the practitioner. However, when people, the whole point of protected health information is to preserve confidentiality. And when you are talking about medically vulnerable individuals for whom physicians and other medical professionals sometimes make judgments about the type of care that they provide based upon that person's vulnerabilities, some of this information could put them in danger. For example, you could have an individual with mental retardation, a child. They will not receive treatment because of that, because a person will say, well, we don't provide that type of treatment to a person that's mentally retarded, or in my experience, mentally retarded people won't progress past this point. They don't... It's very hard to describe this in a non-personal kind of a way. However, I have seen individuals that are medically vulnerable be medically harmed by a release of information that was not helpful and was not authorized. It should be authorized. And if you're going to go down this road, it really should be about improving care, and there should be important safeguards where people are giving consent and we're not releasing information that's going to harm
them. What this road is, the road we're talking about here, is the road that Representative Maurer was talking about. We're talking about that therapist sending a bill to the insurance company, and it's now in an insurance company database. And in a managed care system, it's theoretically there for the benefit of the individuals of that population. So, I mean, it is already extracted from the protected record into a database. What we're talking about here is sharing among two organizations, both with responsibility for the same patient, that insurance company database, so they can be doing planning and other kinds of things. I mean, I think that's where that's what they're talking about. They're not talking about the medical record. They're not talking about the individual case, and that's why I jumped on you. I think they're talking about saying we have this healthcare system database, this mental healthcare system database, and what we want to do is put those two databases together. The data is out there. It's not whether it's in the medical record or not.
So, Mr. Chair, can you assure them that with this bill there will not be clinic notes, progress notes, narratives, dictations that are shared between one provider to another without the explicit consent of a patient?
Well, I think if we're talking about excluding that, and I believe they are, then we ought to get amendments that excludes that, that talks about sharing the information that's in the MCO,
for billing purposes.
Mr. Chair, they can't do that. That would be in violation of federal law. I'm not a lawyer, but that information is not the property of the patient. That information is the property of the clinic, of the organization that's providing
the information. The medical record?
Yes.
No, it isn't.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a quick question, Representative Maurer, and just for the purposes of discussion. Using Representative Gelser's example about the marriage therapist, if the patient really wanted that to be confidential, could they say, "Don't bill my insurance. I'm just going to write you a check."
Absolutely.
Then is it the patient's information? You're talking about the ownership of the information being the clinic's. Is that because of an insurance connection, or is it for some?
You are absolutely correct, and that is the crux of it. When you have insurance, you have, by virtue of that, a contract. Contracts have language in there that, you know, it may be small print, but the reality is that that information is now part of, quote, the system. And you, you know, in this age of computers, that information can be moved around. And but routinely it's not.
But the original medical record, there's no question on the law on that, is owned by the patient. It's in the, it's being held by the physician.
That is not correct, sir.
Can I may ask a clarification of Representative Maurer? So that, so when we're talking about the medical record, not the diagnosis code, not the procedure code, but Sarah Gelser presents today, she weighs this number of pounds, she reports that she was hit by a car last week after eating too many Wheaties. I mean, that does not belong to the patient, and the provider is welcome and free to share that with anybody in the world that they want to because it belongs to them?
Well, no, that would not be correct. They're not. They are restricted in who they can disclose that information to, but that information belongs to the clinic. I have a contract with Blue Cross. I have a contract with the state in various forms. I have private insurance. And the contractor says, you will keep these records for X number of years. At the end of that time, you will destroy those records. I can give you a copy of my records, but I can't just delete that from my system. That is because I'm not allowed to. If I did that, I would be violating the contract.
But Representative Maurer, does that contract with the insurance company, does that require you to disclose without your patient's authorization or consent clinic notes, progress notes, information to another medical provider without that patient's consent?
It's not quite that explicit. The insurance company can come in and say, I want the medical record of this patient who is a Blue Cross patient, et cetera.
Say in a fraud investigation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That information is wide open. But
it only can be used for those very limited purposes.
Absolutely. I mean, there are limitations to that information. If any provider is using information to harm somebody, then I think you would be opening yourself up to a civil lawsuit that probably would see no end. So the issue is about making a system that's very complex and very computer-oriented and making it better. It's if we're talking about harming the patient and intent to harm the patient, then maybe we need to, you know, fire the contractor and find someone else. And I understand your concern. Sorry.
This is a great conversation, and maybe the three of us or others can sit down and have it, but I think I want to get to where we are on this bill. I think if what we're talking about is sharing the claims database of the two systems, then I think we ought to have language that makes this very specific in this and that. That's the issue that we're talking about. I sense that is the issue. Is that not the issue you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, it really is both.
Both what?
You're both at the individual level and at the summary level.
I'm talking about the individual level, but I'm talking about not the medical record itself. I'm talking about the insurance claims record. We've had information here that the record you as an IPA have is an insurance claims file. And if we're talking, and they have an insurance claims file. If we're talking about sharing the insurance claims file, then I think I'd like language here that is more specific to that. And I sense that is what we're talking about. And we're talking about aggregate data also out of the claims. We're not talking about sharing the progress notes, the medical record, the things that's inside that. It is medically, it is individually identified,
mm-hmm.
but it's claims data you're talking about. It's not the medical record data you're talking about. Is that?
And Mr. Chair, this would not override the clinical records that the mental health organizations currently have, which they cannot share, the psychotherapy notes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is not.
Well, but this bill is very broad. Mm-hmm. I mean, in section, in line 6 through 11,
mm-hmm.
right. It's very broad, and it may be overbroad to what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
If what you're trying to do is to share the claims records of these two organizations, then let's get language that talks about that. And then I think it won't
completely put Representative Gelzer at ease, but I think it will make her a little less nervous. And I sense that's what we're talking about. So let's see if we can get an amendment that narrows it to that, because I think for planning purposes, that's what you need. And then...
Is that...
Sure. Yeah, Representative Maurer, perhaps you and Representative Gelzer could work with them to get...
We can duke it out.
To get the language that I think is relevant, because I think that's what you're looking for. And I think this is much broader than I think we need to get you what you want. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Good idea.
Yeah, no.
if I'm wrong in what I'm saying, please somebody come up and tell me.
I'm wrong about who owns that information in the medical record. There's been a lot of case law on that, but we can have another conversation about that.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
We would really like to come to some kind of a resolution to this that would help all parties, so we'd be more than happy to work together.
I think this may have been helpful to get us with that. Thank you very much, Mr. Gelzer. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill... the work session on Senate Bill 163.
We have 10 minutes.
All right. Well, let's see what we can do in the 10 minutes. I think we might not get there, but we sure would like to quit at 4:30. Yeah, all of them have a little piece of issues over there. Let's get Senate Bill 433. Let me open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 433.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 433 allows the State Board of Nursing to abstain from imposing discipline on licensees who voluntarily seek treatment if the board finds that licensee poses no danger to public health, safety, or welfare. You do have in your packet submitted testimony from the Board of Nursing, who could not be in attendance today, requesting your support of the bill. And we have an individual signed up to testify. This has no revenue or fiscal impact. It left the Senate floor 26 aye, 1 no, and 3 excused.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'll be brief with what I think is a very straightforward bill for your consideration. The Board of Nursing, as you know, licenses, among others, nurses, law enforcement agencies, including the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, sometimes conduct investigations and may, on rare occasions, prosecute licensees of the Board of Nursing. That interaction caused the Board of Nursing and the Department of Justice to conduct an examination of the intersection between those overlapping responsibilities, and Senate Bill 433 is the result of one of the results of that examination. You have before you a report that was prepared jointly by the Board of Nursing and the Oregon Department of Justice containing findings and recommendations. And one of those recommendations calls for legislative action, and it takes the form of Senate Bill 433. Pursuant to statutes adopted in 1991, the Board of Nursing operates a program called the Nurse Monitoring Program, or NMP. This program is designed for licensees, nurses in particular, who have chemical dependencies and as a result of those dependencies have somehow run afoul of the regulatory requirements that the board requires of all of its licensees. In exchange for the Board of Nursing's forbearance from continued investigation and prosecution of such nurses, the participants in the nurse monitoring program must agree to adhere to terms and conditions that are established by law and by the Board of Nursing in rules that they adopt. This bill does not create that program. This bill modifies the statute which governs entry into that program. Currently, ORS 678.112 sub 1 establishes the first term or condition for the program. It states that the board cannot admit a person to the nurse monitoring program unless the board finds that there is, quote, no danger to the public health, close quote, period. The Board of Nursing itself, however, has described its mission as extending beyond health to include protection of the public health, safety, and welfare, close quote. The two statements describe different conduct because, for example, theft from a bedridden patient would not create any risk to the public health, arguably, but would constitute conduct that was a risk to public safety or welfare. So what the board does simply, what the bill simply does in line 9 is add the expression safety or welfare to the conditions for entry into the nurse monitoring program, thus squaring the statutory authority for entry into the program with the board's statement of the its mission and it, the scope of its responsibilities. Senate Bill 433 is supported by the Board of Nursing and, as I say, arose from this joint report. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your testimony. Do you know why Senator Gourley voted against it in the
Senate? Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, Senator Gourley expressed concerns, as I understand it, about other aspects of the regulatory scheme applicable to nurses, and in particular, I believe it's always dangerous to characterize someone else's position, but I believe that the concern that Senator Gourley has expressed is that, in her view, the nurse monitoring program ought to be managed and operated by an entity that is independent of the regulatory authority that the Board of Nursing itself.
We'll get to that same issue in a few minutes. On the BME.
Mm-hmm. So I think I fairly captured Senator Gourley's view. It's not my understanding that the bill itself was objectionable as much as it didn't go as far as that she would like the recommendations to go.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And would you give me an example of how the public welfare might be affected? Public safety example is a good one.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, it's a little bit more difficult to come up with a squared away example, and we settled on the language public health, safety, and welfare because it's a phrase that's used often in describing the regulatory authority of licensing agencies, and so my thought was that by using the same kind of phrase, we could borrow some of the existing law about the development of welfare. I'm trying to think off the top of my head of an example that wouldn't be a public safety issue, but would be a welfare issue. It's difficult, I think, to do.
Are you the AG for the nursing?
Mr. Chair, I am not. It happens to be that one of the Assistant Attorneys General assigned to the Board of Nursing is here for another matter. Mr. Foote is in the back of the room. However, I was specifically assigned by the Attorney General to work with the Board of Nursing on the report that you have before you, and so I do have personal knowledge of these aspects of the Board of Nursing's operation.
Could I ask Mr. Foote to join us?
Sure.
Are you all prepared for this?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to raise an issue. I tried to get an amendment ready for this one, and it couldn't quite get into the relating to clause, I think. I didn't have time to argue with the LC on it. But when the Board of Naturopathic Examiners was here to try and pick up the same authority that the BME and the nursing board had to force people into diversion programs, essentially, to require them to be tested, the administrative law section of the Bar Association brought forward an amendment that provided some due process rights for a person requested to undergo an examination at their own expense. I don't suppose you've had a chance to look at that, but somewhere along the line, if we find the occasion, I'd like to make sure. And their argument was, well, the BME doesn't have the nurses, the psychologists, none of them have it. And my argument was good, then we'll make sure they all have it along the way. Is my babbling making any sense?
No, Mr. Chair, I think I'm following the question, because at present, orders for evaluation are considered an order in other than contested case. And so the due process right would be the right to go to circuit court and challenge that order in that forum. I believe what's been...
That is right.
Yeah. What's been proposed is to instead create a right to a contested case hearing pursuant to the order for evaluation. So
exactly.
It's really a question of a different type of due process. Which form would do it? It would be transferring the jurisdiction from the circuit court to the administrative law judge, the Office of Administrative Hearings, and what you would then entail would be, you know, the request for a hearing would trigger then a would go to the administrative Office of Administrative Hearing to assign an ALJ, which I'm sure they could do quickly. But then you'd have the need to have a pre-hearing conference. This would be very similar to an emergency suspension order, where we get counsel for both sides on the phone with the ALJ, a hearing date, but sometimes isn't so quick because counsel are busy with their litigation schedule. Then you have your discovery before the hearing, have your contested case hearing, and then after that, where witnesses are called and documentary evidence is presented. After that, the hearing's closed, the ALJ prepares a proposed order. That proposed order then goes back to the respondent, the licensee, for exceptions if it were to sustain the board's order for evaluation. Then that goes before the board for deliberations, consideration, and issuance of a final order. So you may be talking on a lapsed time of...
Hey, could you identify yourself?
Oh. I'm sorry, Warren Foote with the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. And so that during that time, you have a licensing board that feels that there is significant reason to question the person's psychological, psychiatric condition, whether they're safe to practice. And so while that question's still pending, and they're still continuing to practice, you have this process to complete that hearing and have a decision rendered on it.
You actually have the ability to use an emergency clause to suspend the license.
If the board feels it has enough evidence to find a substantial and imminent risk of harm to the public, which is a higher standard than we think that there's reasonable cause to believe that there's a psychiatric condition. The two may not be the same thing.
Mr. Chair, as to Senate Bill 433, recognize that the nurse monitoring program is a voluntary program, and so that does arise in a different factual context than the one Mr. Foote has described.
It's a voluntary program, but you can force somebody into being evaluated to go into that program.
Now, Mr. Chair, one would be with the nurse monitoring program, a person can would volunteer to go into the monitoring program to be monitored. What I've been discussing is an order for evaluation, and I think that was a question that you were asking, the order for evaluation. Now, the Board of Nursing has the authority to order an evaluation, which could get into the question of, do you have a dependence issue for alcohol, for instance? And if the answer was yes, that would have them into the nurse monitoring program if they were...
It was the order to evaluate.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I guess it's not in the scope of this rule, but thank you for... I wanted to get this on the record because it's... very much in my mind.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And so you're...
Still have a quorum.
Are you suggesting that next session that there probably will be language in a number of these boards similar to the one that we heard and just discussed?
You may see one yet today. let's deal with this, which is a rather simple amendment to the law. Mr. Foote, thank you very much for your participation. Can I have an amendment on move to close public hearing on Senate Bill 433, open a work session on Senate Bill 433, and ask for, there's no amendment to this.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 433 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion of that? Would you please call the roll? And everybody that's not here is excused for one reason or another.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 145 passes. It's
433. Can we move this bill to the consent calendar?
Is there any objection to that? 433 moves to the consent calendar. We have two more bills. I'm going to miss a baby shower, but There's room for one more to go. What do we have? 145
and 229.
Let's hear 229. Let me open a work session. So it's the first public hearing? Okay. Let's have a public hearing on Senate Bill 229A. Sandy, will you tell us about it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 229A authorizes the State Board of Psychologists Examiners under specified circumstances to order a psychological, physical, and psychiatric assessment of licensees. It establishes confidentiality provision, as you've just heard. This is similar to some other examiner boards' authority. Looking to revise that, you will see that you have a dash A5 amendment. When we originally heard from the Administrative Law Section of the Bar Association in his written testimony, this bill was also highlighted, and so we have an amendment before us that addresses his concerns as outlined in their testimony. This has no revenue impact, and there is just a minimal fiscal off the A engrossed version without any evaluation of the pending amendment, Mr. Chair.
What do you know? There's that amendment.
There's that amendment.
Okay. This was brought to us by the Board of Medical by the Board of Psychological Examiners.
Correct.
Can we start with some testimony from them, please? Is that Mr. Porter? Are you going to be back on this one? And Deborah Orman. Tina, would you take this? I'll be right here.
Sure. Good afternoon. Just if you would state your name for the record, and I think start off with Deborah Orman, I would guess.
Okay. My name is Deborah Orman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Psychologist Examiners. We are a consumer protection agency. We also license and discipline psychologists in the state of Oregon, as well as sanction those who practice unlicensed.
And I guess what the background of why the bill's coming forward.
Senate Bill 229 was proposed by the board to give us another tool to use in our investigation when a complaint is filed against a licensee. We collect all kinds of information that would be pertinent to the case that would help us either prove or disprove the complaint that was made. And for the board, it's another tool that, as I said, we can use to help us ascertain what's going on with that particular licensee. What I guess I'd really like to say in large part is that we feel like it wouldn't be used often, and the other boards that do have this authority use it judiciously, and it would be the same with us. Sort of the way it was introduced, it sounded as if we would ask a physical, psychological, and drug and alcohol evaluation on every complainant, that every licensee who receives a complaint, and that's not the case. It would be only when those issues had come into play. I also wanted to talk about the proposed amendment, if I could.
Mm-hmm. Please.
Absolutely. Why don't we ask Mr. Risberger to come forward and talk about that amendment?
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up, Sandy, I have a dash 4 and a dash 5. Is the dash 5 on the
screen? And somebody else will be speaking to the dash.
The dash 4. Do I have that too?
I can't figure out what the difference is.
I don't have a dash 4.
One moment, please. I mean, you can continue on. I need to look. It's all I have. You look.
Does the dash 4 look like the dash 5?
It looks very much like the dash 5. There's stuff on the back.
I think.
The dash 4 is dated the 30th of April.
And off the record? You could. I didn't have a conference. You could have done
Oh. Okay, so it's the same thing.
I have this photocopy.
Okay.
So.
All right.
It is a duplication, Mr. Chair.
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Well, that makes it look exactly alike. Okay. Mr. Richard,
Greenleaf, members of the Healthcare Committee, and my name is Steve Risberger. I'm the chair of the Administrative Law Section for the Oregon State Bar. The issues that are raised by our proposed amendments, the Dash 5 amendments, are essentially identical to those that were raised and you considered in connection with our proposed amendments to Senate Bill 207, the bill regarding a naturopathic board. This committee is obviously well informed about these issues regarding due process rights to someone who's subjected to a compelled medical or mental examination. And I don't want to repeat remarks that I've made previously, so perhaps what I will do is simply ask whether you have questions for me at this time.
Well, let's give them a chance to respond. Yes, you wanted to respond specifically to the Deborah, to the amendments.
Okay. I would like to say I'm a little blindsided because I didn't see it until it was on the table today. It looks like it just came out. I wasn't able to talk about it, but I had heard that the naturopaths had dealt with a similar issue, so I had a sense it might be coming, and so I looked at what their proposed one was because that was all that I had.
It's basically the same.
It's very busy. Okay. Anyway, I guess I wanted to say that the board, at first blush, it looks like a due process, additional due process rights, but the board has three concerns. One is the fact that the investigation would be protracted by this, as Mr. Foote suggested, that it would drag things out. The second is the cost. I think there's been a little misleading information about the cost of a hearing, both the cost for the administrative law judge as well as all the staff in the Office of Administrative Hearings that we pay for to do everything from shred a document to make an email or send a letter. And we are charged $48 an hour for things like sending emails and phone calls, and it gets very expensive.
Would this be more expensive than a civil court hearing? I mean, a circuit court hearing?
That I don't know. I don't have experience with that.
I mean, because right now they have a right to appeal to the circuit court. I assume this would be a less expensive alternative to that.
I would think the other way. Do you know?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Warren Foote. In my experience, I've had one case which I represented the Board of Medical Examiners in circuit court, and so the Board of Medical Examiners paid for my time to go before the circuit court judge, and that process took us about 30 to 40 days to do in terms of having the hearing, having the decision come out from the circuit court judge. I couldn't actually speak to the specific cost of my time, except I think it took probably about the same amount of attorney time to do that as it would be for an administrative hearing, in terms of my time preparing for a hearing and actually doing the case.
And in terms of documents, I mean, I'm worried about all those things.
I believe about the same, Mr. Chair.
So it wouldn't be an additional cost over a right that they have right now. If one of your respondents, as you said, right now could appeal the request for an examination in the circuit court, where they could do it under this process. Is there anything that would lead you to think that if they did it under this process, it would be more expensive than if they did it under a circuit court appeal?
Mr. Chair, I can say that we've had, my 9 years with the Department of Justice, I've only had one appearance in circuit court on an order for evaluation. I think that we would see more hearings, because it would be available as an administrative hearing. I think there would probably be more licensees requesting a hearing.
So the barriers would be lower under this, and they might...
I think the perception, perhaps.
Mr. Risberger, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I would have to agree that I think if an administrative proceeding is offered in response to compelled physical or mental examination, that you'll find that folks that are ordered to undergo those kinds of examinations are going to be requesting hearings more often, and primarily because it's going to be less expensive and because also there'll be some guarantees regarding confidentiality. If it goes through a circuit court proceeding, my understanding is that would be public record.
And the administrative law judge wouldn't be?
Mr. Chair, if I could respond. I think that the proceedings were sealed in circuit court. You can request to have the proceedings, the actual hearing, and the records sealed, which is what I did, because we were dealing with confidential records. And the hearings before the Minister of Law Judge are closed and are not open to the public, as well, and the record, because it contains health records as well as investigatory records, is not, it's confidential and it's not open to the public. I think the difference between circuit court and administrative hearing in addition would be that the agency gets billed for the time of the LJ and all those attendant costs with having an administrative hearing, which does not happen with circuit court.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Orman, how many of these county cases would you anticipate in a year, do you think? How often? I'm just curious. I'm trying to get a sense of the scale to address your issue around expensive process. And of course, this doesn't require a hearing either. You know, if someone is found to be not practicing psychology safely and they know there's a hearing, it doesn't mean they have to apply for one. I'm just trying to get a sense of how many you think you might be having to investigate in the course of a year.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kotek, I've been in this job 8 months and we've had one where we asked somebody to have an evaluation. It's the board's feeling, and they spoke with our professional association over the weekend about this at their conference, that as we age as a population, there'll be more of these come up related to aging and people's fitness and that sort of thing. So they do anticipate more, and we were already, I guess, kind of on that the cusp of that already.
Thank you. And I was wondering if the Psychologists Association was planning to testify.
Yeah, they are.
Okay. Thank you.
And I just wanted to tell me about Section 3 at the end of the bill, particularly Section 3, Part 2. That automatically deems a psychologist licensee has given consent to submit to this exam. Is that what? So
I guess
they have no choice under the current thing. They have to submit.
Chair Greenlake, that would be correct. They already agreed to other things. I'm drawing a blank on them. As part of their licensing procedure. Oh, gosh. Can you?
And, excuse me, Mr. Chair, I believe that I think the Board of Psychology was drawing on other similar language in bills. Think that the thinking being that as licensees apply for this privilege of practicing this healthcare profession, that they're deemed to have consented to certain inquiries into their background, their mental, and healthcare ability to practice safely.
Well, that's not what it says. What it says is they're deemed to consent to submit to psychological, physical, and psychiatric assessment when so directed by the board. That's pretty broad, isn't it?
Chair Greenlake, as Mr. Foote said, in our application process now, we have other language in the bill, in our bill, in our laws that say that when they apply for licensure, we can request other materials other than what is in the application if we have questions about their character and fitness, and it mirrors that language.
So you could, I apply to be a licensed psychologist, you could make me take a physical exam?
No. We have other language that talks about that we can inquire further if we have question about an applicant's fitness or character, and this just mirrors when they apply for licensure, they're also agreeing that should this come up, should there be a complaint filed, and should there be question about their fitness.
It doesn't say anything about a complaint.
Well, the original one.
Reasonable basis.
Yeah, the other.
Section 1 says it, but Section 2 doesn't.
You're looking at the original bill.
Yes.
Oops. Not the amendment. Are you looking at the amendment or the...
I'm looking at their bill.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at your bill, the A. and Grove Senate Bill 229. It says in the very last paragraph, I'll read it to you, a psychologist licensed by the board shall be deemed to have given consent to submit to psychological, physical, or psychiatric assessment when so directed by the board. That's pretty strong. Huh? The board decide they don't like me, I can end up having a physical, a psychiatric, and a psychological exam at my expense, I'm sure. For no reason, just because the board tells me to.
Mr. Chair, the board is comprised of members drawn from the licensing community, the license community of psychologists, as well as public members, and they're the ones that exercise the discretion on whether they think the need for public safety would cause them to issue this order for evaluation. And so the statute does indicate, as you indicated, that the psychologist is deemed to have given consent to such ordered evaluations. And so that is the compulsion there under the law. The 229A version of the Senate bill, which is before you now, has in Section 1 that the board must have reasonable cause to doubt the fitness of a licensee to practice psychology, and if they have that reasonable cause, they may direct and order the psychologist to submit to the evaluation. The Part 2 says, and psychologists are deemed to have given consent to such evaluations.
Yes,
they are. Well, Part 2 follows from Part 1.
Well, let me ask some more. Page 675, I mean, Section 1, on line 6 of the first page, it says the State Board of Psychology Exemption has the following powers in addition to the powers granted. Item 16 of that is to require a licensed psychologist to undergo a physical, psychological, or psychiatric examination as provided in Section 3. So it says that I can order it, and you consented to it.
And Mr. Chair, as long as we adopt the dash 5, as long as it's the board considers it objectively reasonable. And I think we've had discussion. What bill was it that we had that discussion on?
That's why I think we need the dash 5. Okay. Is there any other questions for these folks? We have two others who want to testify. Three others. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we sir, before they leave, I have a quick question.
Oh, okay.
On the paragraph 2 of Section 3 that Chair Greenlich was talking about, under current law, do you operate as if you have that consent, or is this completely new language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonacci?
Bonamici?
I'm sorry.
Happens all the time.
The board does not have the authority at present to order an evaluation. So right now the board would ask a licensee to undergo the evaluation, but if they say no, that's the end of the matter. So this bill would give the board for the first time the authority to order an evaluation, and the Section 3 of this bill would require them to have reasonable cause before they could, in fact, order that evaluation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Yes, please.
And this panel may not be the right panel to ask that, but when these come up, and I guess this is the second or third time this has come up, it makes me wonder, are we doing this on sort of a hodgepodge basis? I mean, where within the larger medical community, is this the precedent and your particular discipline has fallen behind, or are we setting a new precedent here and everything else we're going to be struggling to catch up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, you won't find uniformity among the health licensing professions. There are other boards that presently have this authority, others that do not. And so in this case, I think the Board of Naturopaths, I believe the Board of Dentistry, the Board of Psychology have come forward asking for that authority.
The other boards have.
Thank you.
Any other questions? We have Mr. Bratz from the Board of Dentistry, Mr. McTeague from the Board of Chiropractors, and we have Fitzgerald representing the Oregon Psychological Association. I know. I'm not taking over. Ms. Earls, let's hear from you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Reaction to this whole thing.
Okay.
Your clients.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing the Oregon Psychological Association. The Oregon Psychological Association worked with Ms. Orman and the Board of Psychologist Examiners on the Senate side to narrow Senate Bill 229 to make our members feel more comfortable about the requirements that the board would have to undergo before ordering a physical or mental evaluation of our licensees. And we do appreciate having worked with Ms. Orman and her flexibility in putting together some amendments to the original bill. That said, the Psychological Association did meet over the weekend and considered the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 229, and the association has taken a position of support of those amendments. For a couple reasons, it would provide them with the right to request a limited contested case hearing to challenge the validity of the alleged facts that are giving rise to the compelled evaluations. They feel like this would provide them a little bit more assurance that if, in fact, they had a strong reason to feel that the request for evaluation was not legitimate, it would give them a better chance to talk with the agency, to contest the agency's request before going forward with those evaluations.
So
that's where we are.
Thank you for taking the time to go over it with the association.
Sure. Okay. Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Patrick Bratson. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. To correct Mr. Foote, the Board of Dentistry currently has this power. And it's the reason I'm here today to testify is because we're concerned about what may be happening in the future. This legislature and the legislatures before have asked us to protect the public. When we get a complaint, and let's use an example of a sexual misconduct for a dentist, we start an investigation, and we find certain things that this has maybe happened once or twice or numerous times, we will usually meet with that dentist along with their legal counsel and say, you know, we think there may be some problems, and maybe you have some psychological problems, maybe you have some physical problems, but in order for us to go forward with the investigation, we think you need to have an evaluation, a sexual evaluation, psychosexual evaluation, whatever the need has to be. I've been with the board 4 years. We've used this once, and in actually using it, we said, we'd like you to do this. If you don't want to do it, then we're going to make it. We're going to go to the process of issuing the order. In this particular case, the person said, yes, I will go ahead and do it. You don't have to issue the order. What did we find out? This person did have serious psychological problems. And so what did the board do? They entered a disciplinary order. I think this is a great harm if you take this power away from boards. They have the right through circuit court right now. And to answer your question, Chair Green, like, the costs will go up. The administrative hearings is a very expensive process borne by the board. In circuit court, we're not paying for that except for the legal fees that we have to represent to that. So there are some increased costs to this.
Who is paying? Is that free? There's no charge?
Well, I assume that the taxpayers of Oregon pay for circuit court, but in reality, this will be coming out of licensing fees and out of our board support, and it is very expensive to go to administrative hearings. They cost anywhere from... The last one we just did was, we've only done one, was somewhere around $12,000. So if we're going to do a sort of a mini contested case hearing before we actually get to the hearing, it's going to be very expensive. We don't do this willy-nilly. This has to be very serious matters for the boards to use this. And so, you know, the reason I'm here today is, I'm not opposing the psychology board getting this type of thing. What I'm doing is saying the amendments are very concerning to us because I can see what will be happening in the next session of the legislature. They'll be saying, let's take this away from the medical board, let's take it away from the dentistry board, let's take it away from the nursing board. This is a very important tool if we're going to continue to protect the public. Now, like I said, if there's a particular reason, and I said this in the last session of the legislature, if there's a particular board that someone feels is abusing these powers, then they should bring those issues to the forefront, to this committee or whatever committee of the legislature, and let's work on that. But instead of destroying something that works very well for a number of regulatory boards, I cannot see making the change. And so I'll be more than happy to answer any of your questions.
And your testimony is you had 3 complaints of sexual abuse and you didn't exercise your emergency powers immediately?
What we said is, as a part of the investigation, there were some issues that came up. And in this case, no, we did not, because at the time, we did not have sufficient evidence. We got that evidence when we got the evaluation.
Hmm. And if they had contested the evaluation?
It would have gone to circuit court.
And you wouldn't have used your emergency powers to suspend the license?
At that particular point, I don't believe so, because we didn't find out information until that evaluation.
Hmm. Is anybody meet you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barrett, you have mentioned a couple of times in your testimony taking this power away from the boards, and I don't see it as taking the power away from the boards. I see it as putting in a safeguard for the person who may be have a rightful reason to dispute the order to go get this assessment, and it doesn't take the tool away. Is that not correct? Am I missing something? Because you said we're taking it away and by this amendment. And
Chair Greenwood, Representative Bonamici, what you're doing is you're changing the way it is currently done. Circuit court is a very fast process. I guess as Warren Foote has mentioned to you, the process took 30 or 40 days. Our experience with contested case hearings is they're a very lengthy process, can be months in cases of getting them scheduled, and so this would actually prolong the issue and actually run up the cost of the issue. Where my understanding is, again, we've never had to actually issue one of these in the sense, at least in my four-year tenure, and we've never had to defend it in circuit court. But if we did, that would be a faster track than it would be in the administrative hearing process.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
It's really hard to imagine.
Just a brief follow-up. Yeah, Mr. Risperger's testimony talks about how this would be, he anticipates an accelerated and limited contested case hearing, so I just don't see it as something that's going to be dragging on.
Well, Chair Greenlick, Representative, I can only go by what our assistant attorney generals tell us in the cases that they have to prosecute. I'm not a lawyer. I don't pretend to be one. When I go to them for that advice, that's the advice I get from them, is that the experience we have with contested case hearings are they are a much lengthier process.
Senator Maurer.
We're not debating the dentist today, so
we're
I'm going to pass.
We will. And the chiropractors.
Briefly, Mr. Chair. Dave McTeague, Executive Director, Board of Chiropractic Examiners, here for the similar reasons and also in support of our sister board, the Board of Psychologists Examiners. The amendments, proponents at the last hearing.
The physical therapy board ought to have.
I'll punt on that one. The amendments proponents claimed this hearing process would be an expedited show cause hearing, as Representative Bonamici just pointed out, but that's not what the amendments say. You heard Warren Foote go through the contested case process. It is a challenging process. There's no language in the proposed amendments which ensures prompt appointment of the administrative law judge. We assume they would be appointed promptly, but it doesn't say that. There's nothing to ensure prompt scheduling of a hearing. Often there has to be a preliminary conference to set up the schedule. And then as those of you that are lawyers know how difficult it is to schedule lawyers and get everybody all in the same room at the same time, not to mention the ALJ's caseload to be juggled too. There's no limits on motions that may be filed before the ALJ by creative legal counsel claiming there's this case and there's this case and there's this precedent and that precedent, and the ALJ's got to go out and research all these precedents and then write his opinion about those rulings. And after you have the contested case, at the contested case hearing, there's no limits on witnesses that can be called by defense counsel.
You've read the amendment, right?
Yeah.
Section 4.
Yeah.
Chair, may I jump in?
Yes, please.
Thank you. And I really do appreciate, Mr. McTeague, the detail of what we could improve upon. So my question would be, if we tighten up and makes very specific in terms of the timeline so we don't have drawn-out hearings and some of the issues you raise, would you be supportive?
I'd be getting closer. but that's all. We're a long ways from that yet, and you still have a cleaner process by simply going to the circuit court and getting the record sealed, as Mr. Foote said. And also in terms of due process, doesn't compute for me is the proponents of the amendment want to give it to the administrative law judge who issues a proposed order that goes back to the board for final decision. Conceivably, the board could say, Well, you know, that's nice that you wrote that proposed order, but we've got more experience with this than you do, Mr. Administrator or Mrs. Administrative Law Judge. And we disagree, and we're going to issue the final order anyway, saying we really need this competency evaluation to occur. So, you know, the final decision is still rests with the board, according to all the complicated rules that have been set up by the Office of Administrative Hearings, whereas you go to that circuit court judge and you get one clean hearing and a nice clean up or down, yes or no, there you go. So I just kind of, in terms of the due process argument, I'm just kind of puzzled by why they do that. And then the cost thing, I agree with... you know, with some of the previous testimony, the cost of this hearing, it's really hard to peg. But I can tell you one thing. Some of the testimony that was given by the bar was citing numbers of like $310 average hearing cost or $192 for some telephone hearing. That's not the kind of hearings that we hold, and the kind of, especially when the attorneys get involved and people are calling witnesses and making motions, the costs run up real fast at $109 an hour for AAG. So
I think for the board of psychological examiners, they'll have the opportunity to figure out how bad they want the original bill.
And you know, really,
they can put a $500,000 fiscal on it and kill the bill.
Those boards that have this authority use it, I believe, very, very, very sparingly, and it's used in those few cases where we really do. The board lacks the expertise to do these evaluations, whether it's a substance abuse evaluation or a psychosexual evaluation. It's not appropriate in every case.
You
so
did these amendments.
Excuse me?
You did read that.
Absolutely.
You know that substance abuse is excluded?
No, that's not. That's incorrect. Well, this. I read that provision to refer to like a UA. Okay, you know, if the board wants to tell a licensee to go pee in a bottle, then they have to go do it.
Because the provisions in the section do not apply to board orders requiring tests for controlled substances.
That's tests. That's how I read that. When I'm thinking of a substance abuse situation, which we've had a couple of, we say to the licensee, you need to go to Hazelden, Springbrook, and Newburgh, and you need to get that 3-day intensive evaluation done as to the extent of your addiction to painkiller medicines. And I don't think that's what that provision is speaking to. I think that I read that as being, you know, boards will often say you've had a lot of drunk driving incidences, and we'd like you to get drug tested 3 times just to show us that you're clean and sober. That's what that refers to. You'd have to rewrite that section if you wanted to give us carte blanche to order competency examinations related to a pattern of substance abuse behavior.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hear a motion on the... it's a public hearing. Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 229. Do I hear a motion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would move Dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 229.
Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering if I would like to move to make a conceptual amendment to line 17 of the Dash A5s. As you recall, when we were talking about the naturopaths, we had reduced the 20 days to 10. Yeah. I would move a conceptual amendment to change line 17 to read within 10 days after receipt of the notice.
Administrator, is that all right with you?
That is acceptable. It's about then the one word.
Okay. One word or one number?
One word, one number. Change.
Is there...
Yes. Mr. Chair. So I've thought about this a lot since we voted on this in regards to the naturopaths last week, and I supported the amendment with some degree of discomfort because we talked about coming back and doing this with other boards. However, it's that support of that amendment is something that has stuck with me for the last several days, and I continue to have questions that were increased by the testimony today. And so
we close this and think about it.
What?
Could close this.
Could we?
Sure.
That would be helpful.
And we'll have more folks here as well.
Yes, I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
And does that work with you?
If at your discretion, Mr. Chair, the comment that I wanted to make is that even Mr. McTeague said this is something that's used very sparingly. And if it's used very sparingly, I don't think that it's very persuasive to argue, it's going to be so expensive.
because it's not used very often. And in the cases where they do want to order this, I believe that it's important for the whether it be a psychologist or naturopath to be able to say, is this a valid request?
Okay. Well, let me ask the committee the question. Are we ready to go, or should we hold it till the next step?
It's your discretion, Mr. Chair.
Sure. I'm perfectly comfortable with this.
I'm too.
I'm so lonely.
Well, let's go my colleague if she wants to wait a day or two.
No, I'm happy to move it if you'll indulge my no vote on the amendment.
Oh, happy to.
Thank you.
Let's have a roll call on the amendment, please.
And is this with the conceptual?
This includes the conceptual.
Representative
Byrne. Aye. Representative Cannon excused. Representative Flores excused. Representative Gelson.
No.
Representative Maurer.
Aye. Vice Chair
Cochran.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Richardson
excused. Chair Greenwald.
Aye.
The bill is amended. Mr. Chair, yes. I would move Senate Bill 229 as amended. 229A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I have a question. I'm just curious. With the amendment, I am wondering if the proponents of the original bill, when that bill comes up for a vote, do they continue to be proponents of the bill as amended?
Is my question
making sense?
No, it makes great sense.
Probably not.
What's your...
Chair,
want to not come up?
Oh.
No, whichever you want. The bill's now amended. The question is, do you still support the bill?
For the record, I'm Deborah Orman, Executive Director of the Board of Psychologist Examiners. I will take a straw poll, and I'd have to get back to you.
We're too late. We're about to vote on it.
They asked me to speak against the amendment.
But they didn't tell you what to do in the whole. Let's hold this.
Okay.
You check.
Mr. Chair, I would move my motion for moving the entire bill, and so we'll just have it back to us as amended for further discussion.
And let us know. We'll reschedule it for stick it in for Thursday. We do it first thing on Thursday. No, let's go Thursday.
Thursday. Carry it over to Thursday.
Yeah, sure. We'll do it the first thing on Thursday.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair,
yep.
I would just like to thank the other boards for coming forward and thinking about this. Mm-hmm. This has been an interesting side story for the session in terms of these bills. So,
well, the interesting, it's very different for somebody who's coming, like the naturopaths and the psychologists, to add this authority. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, they want to add it in a restricted way. It's very different from a board that already has the authority and doesn't want it tampered with. So, we'll see. Let's close the public hearing on the work session on Senate Bill 229A. We'll reschedule it for first bill Thursday. And I think we're going to have to reschedule the remaining bill on our Senate Bill 145A as well. When... Let's do that Thursday as well.
It's up to you.
Tomorrow's pretty busy, is that right? Do I remember that?
Tomorrow. Oh. Well, if the folks can come back tomorrow, we're under a 24-hour notice, so carrying it over till tomorrow.
Carry over without notice anyway, can't we?
Right. I believe.
I do want to give the psychological examiners a chance to.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
On Senate Bill 145, are the proponents aware of the Dash A5 amendments?
Yep, I'm sure they are.
That's tomorrow's. It's all work session from your access cell. Can you come back tomorrow?
Tomorrow will be better. What's your...
Well. What?
Okay, let's do it first thing tomorrow.
Some gentleman can't come back.
You can't come back tomorrow?
I don't know who he is.
I'm speaking on behalf of our
psychiatrist. For the... How about if you give testimony right now? Please, come up and introduce yourself.
I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 145.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Henry Grass. I'm a psychiatrist. I've been in practice for 30 years. A good majority, I'll make this brief as I can.
Oh, you're fine.
A good majority of my practice, a good part of my practice is treating physicians. I've treated over 300 physicians. I'm on the clinical staff at the medical school, as well as in private practice. I've given many talks and led some research projects on physician mental health problems and physician suicide. We've had in Oregon two epidemics of physician suicide in the last 25 years, as you may well know. All of these cases involved physicians who were severely depressed, had multiple circumstances in their personal and professional lives that led them to this dramatic act. I can't say whether this proposed bill will prevent physician suicide. It may very well, and it certainly will hopefully prevent the destruction of a physician's career if we can intervene in timely fashion. Many physicians who suffer from one form of mental illness or another, usually depression or bipolar illness, and or may have co-occurring character problems, are resistant to treatment for a variety of reasons that I think are actually talked about in the bill. But among them are fear of loss of credentialing and a variety of other issues that affect their willingness to come forward. Should I stop?
No. Oh, okay. Please. I was just trying to find out where the doctor was.
So, the Oregon Psychiatric Association, which I'm a representative of in this particular area, has strongly wanted to add mental health provisions to the chemical dependency aspects of the health professionals program. In my particular case, I've seen too many physicians get their careers destroyed. I've gone through the psychological autopsies of physicians who've died. I've interviewed surviving families. It's a painful experience. Most of these physicians that have this happen to them are so ill that they cannot exercise good judgment. You know, the medical board has a very difficult dual responsibility. They, of course, have to protect the public. In recent years, the Oregon Psychiatric Association has been heartened by the fact that the board has tried to take on a real rehabilitative function. Unfortunately, many of the physicians that I treat and talk with about this are frightened of the medical board, and for a variety of reasons that I'm sure you're all aware of. So if we could get a program that has to do with confidential treatment of physicians that have mental disorders but don't necessarily have chemical dependency, I believe that we could salvage the careers and perhaps the lives of a lot of physicians. We lose one physician per year to suicide in this state, and the rate is growing. Now, that is the final painful outcome of a physician who has not somehow or other been able to get appropriate mental health care. Some of these cases probably never would have come to the attention of anyone, but others, the physicians clearly are demonstrating their troubled behavior to their colleagues around them. So if we could have an intervention process, much like is available for physicians or all these other health professionals that you've talked about today, that would allow them to get confidential and protected treatment that they could contract for and follow the regulations of that treatment board, that would allow them to receive the treatment and cooperate with the treatment, I believe we could save some careers and some lives.
Yeah, I'm sort of astounded. I didn't realize that mental health was not included.
Well, it is in many other states. Most often it was included in the early bills in the 90s that went through, that chemical dependency and mental disorders were included at the same time. It's been a difficult uphill battle in those states where mental disorders was not included in the initial bills, and Oregon is one of those states. So this is our second time around trying to get this bill through. Last time around it was withdrawn. So whatever you have to do to get this bill through, I would greatly appreciate it, and so would my psychiatric colleagues. And I think potentially the lives and careers of a lot of physicians out there.
Thank you very much. I hope this bill doesn't get tangled in some other issues.
I do, too. I know there's other problems with it that are beyond my ability to really speak authoritatively about, but I'm just here to tell you, as one of the key physicians in this state that treats physicians, this is a very important bill to try and get through in some form or other.
Are there any questions of Dr. McCulley?
Dr. Grass.
Oh, Dr. Grass. I'm sorry. I looked on the wrong line.
That's all right.
It was an or. Which one, McCulley? Yes, excuse me. Representative Maurer.
Thank you. In Grant's past, in the last, I think, 3 years, we've lost one physician to suicide.
Yes, I'm aware of that case.
We had another physician that attempted suicide.
Yes.
And that's that I know of. And not only was it obviously a profound loss to the families, but it had a devastating impact on the medical community.
Absolutely.
In Grant's past.
Right.
And the community reeled for months, especially after the one that the actual suicide, and undoubtedly had a negative impact on our ability to deliver health care in Grants Pass.
I'm here to tell you that when physicians decide to take their lives, they're extremely successful about it. It's always by violent means. There's no ambivalence involved in it whatsoever. And it usually is because they feel ashamed and as though there's no ability to reconstruct their lives. If they lose their medical license for one reason or another, most of them feel as though I have nothing else to do in my life. This is who I am. This is what I do. And I have several cases like this where people have lost their licenses. And their entire lives are in disarray. And this is a loss to the community as well. If these cases had received appropriate and timely treatment ahead of time, hopefully many of these individuals would have been rehabilitated. Not all. Some have mental illness that is beyond the ability for us to appropriately deal with. And I've had, unfortunately, some of those cases as well. But if we could get timely intervention for physicians who don't necessarily really see that they have a problem or feel as though there's help for them, because in some ways they're afraid of the very organizations that are there to help them, and their judgment about that is impaired.
Well, thank you so much for coming. And I
thank you, Dr.
Any other questions?
Thank you for taking the time to
listen. I appreciate you coming back tomorrow. Good to see you again. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 145. We'll have it first thing tomorrow. We will have a floor session at 4 o'clock tomorrow, so we'll have an abbreviated session, and we may take up much of it with this bill, so it may.
Well, this is the only public hearing, Mr. Chair. Everything else is a work session.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you all so much.
Adjourned.